SBS live streams and podcasts are supported by advertising.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales@sbs.com.au.
You're listening to SBS On The Money with Ricardo Gonçalves.
It is your daily 10-minute business and finance news wrap for this Thursday, the 4th of July 2024. The Australian share market had a good day today, up 1.2%. We'll have the details with market analyst Evan Lucas a little bit later. But first to ASIC, where former chair James Shipton says a Senate recommendation to break up the corporate regulator following a 20-month investigation is worthy of consideration. For more, Rainer Bosch spoke with him from Cambridge.
It's an important report. The read is very sobering, there are a number of observations. But most importantly, the recommendations that come out of the report are very much worthy of consideration and recommendation. And I think that that we should be concentrating on those recommendations because, to be frank, the Commonwealth has been looking at regulatory best governance since the ERIG report in 2003. That's over two decades ago. And we've had multiple Senate inquiries into ASIC and others. We've had Royal Commissions, and nothing's really changed. In 2003, the ERIG report raised many of the issues that have been raised in this report. So over two decades later, we're still arguing and talking about the same types of things. And that comes down to regulatory practice and regulatory structure and regulatory best governance.
Now, at the heart of this report is this sentiment that ASIC has simply been overburdened, overloaded in its remit. And to kind of tackle this, there's been this idea put forward that breaking up ASIC would be the best response. Is that the right response?
Well, two things. Firstly, ASIC and many other regulators are overburdened. ASIC, compared to its global peers, is one of the most demanded of regulators in the world. It is overburdened on a global basis as well as an Australian basis. It's being asked to do too much with too little, and that's been the case for decades now. ASIC's jurisdiction has expanded and expanded and expanded. Unfortunately, successive governments haven't provided the commensurate level of budget support and indeed policy and other support. As regards the second point, breaking it up, I certainly think that that is something worthy of consideration. But this will be difficult. And it's not just a matter of breaking up ASIC or separating out ASIC or reallocating functions of ASIC to others. What we need to do is design a regulatory system that is appropriate for the financial and corporate system in this country. It's not just a matter of fixing one regulator. It's not just a matter of tweaking a rule book here and there. Regulatory systems are needed to regulate and ensure the proper functioning of an entire system. And in this case, the financial and corporate system in Australia, and for that matter globally, is incredibly complex. So my recommendation is certainly look very carefully at the recommendations of the Senate inquiry, but don't rush to any conclusions. It needs thoughtful, thematic, and systematic thinking.
That's Rainer Bosch there speaking with the former ASIC chair, James Shipton. Now to some data out of the ABS, which says there are now 5.5 million Australians with disability. That's an increase from 4.4 million in 2018. Most of them older Australians, but those in the workforce are also up. The labour force participation rate for people aged 15 to 64 with disability is also increasing at 60.5%. For more, I spoke with Marijke Jonkers, the president of People with Disability Australia.
It's actually really significant because for about 30 years, we've had the same statistic that you're twice as likely to be unemployed if you live with a disability. There are a number of reasons which could have grown. During this time, between the last time a survey and now, they've changed to self-reporting that you have a disability rather than a diagnosis. So the data we're actually analyzing is not apples and apples. It's apples and oranges. But also the COVID pandemic, for all of the havoc it wreaked, it brought a much more accessible, inclusive workplace for many people with disabilities by getting rid of the barriers for transport, for needing an accessible office. A lot of people who are re-entering an office for the first time after being employed for many years during the pandemic, their colleagues are reeling for the first time that they have a colleague with a disability because it wasn't obvious or visible during the pandemic in a home environment. And that really went to show that it's society barriers that we had that stopped inclusion.
So really, ultimately, I guess it's greater awareness, a lot of that too, then. What role do you think employers play in encouraging equity in the workforce?
It's a really key role and something we probably need to prioritize. We're now prioritizing gender and other diversity because we recognize the value that's bringing to the and the lived experience that's bringing, but we don't actually have benchmarks and tracking for disability at the moment to be able to compare across companies, how is it going? And that would be, you know, when you measure something, you get an outcome on it. For employers, that can what can make a big difference is leading by example, making sure that it's not just about a physically accessible place because people think disability and think wheelchair. And that is a tiny percentage of people who live with disabilities, making sensory areas, flexible work environments. Somebody that may be deaf or blind and is perfectly capable of doing the job, but the colleagues aren't going to know how. As the boss, you can come in and speak with the person. There's government support to help you do it and make the workplace welcoming and inclusive, leading by example. And we do have that responsibility as leaders now, including in my own organization.
That's employers. What about the role of other employees?
If you're in an office, look around and you don't see or know anyone with a disability, start wondering why and what needs to change. And should you find yourself with a new colleague, they're going to be able to tell you what they need. They're the expert in your own life, in their own life. And if they've been hired, they can do the job. So get rid of the doubts. And because what the COVID pandemic showed us is what we can do when we're given the opportunity.
And finally, what kind of regulatory changes do you think needs to be made for greater encouragement of diversity in the workplace?
There's a large number of things contained in the Royal Commission, from transport to social barriers that will really address some of that that's regulatory, and the Disability Discrimination Act that's proposed. And so that's addressing the barriers to even being able to come to being at the point of employment. But also, if we're now going to start tracking gender and measuring a gender gap between males and females, it would be wonderful to actually see that data getting collected, because we've seen an increase in employment. But something that we really are aware of is it doesn't tell us if this is meaningful employment or underemployment. Sometimes you can have someone with a master's or a PhD flipping burgers in McDonald's, and the disability employment system ticks that off as employed. And was that a meaningful career pathway and a good use and investment of that person? So what we could be looking at here then is what is the person doing? How many disabled people are employed? And what are they doing? And what is that career trajectory looking like for them? Also, support for working for yourself, because a lot of people with disabilities ultimately find that's the most accessible way.
That's Marijke Jonkers there, the President of People with Disability Australia.
Why do people want to be at work? To feel heard, appreciated, part of something, and to know there's a career path for everyone. Inclusive workplaces are linked to increased innovation, productivity, and employee satisfaction. Make your organisation a place where people want to be. For inclusion and diversity training, visit inclusion-program.com.au.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, Market Day on the SBS On The Money podcast.
The Australian share market had a good day today. The S&P ASX 200 up by 1.2% to 7,831. For more, I spoke with market analyst Evan Lucas. Evan, can we talk global markets first of all? Because the US, in particular, the S&P 500 and technology-based NASDAQ hit a record overnight. Japan's Nikkei is also at a record. What's going on here?
Yeah, and you need to also point out how many times they've made a record this calendar year. So it's 33 trading days of calendar year 2024. It's on track to break its record, which was about 63 times it did it back in 2021 when it was rallying massively off the COVID lows. So what's going on here is also feeds into your question about Japan, is that it's actually sort of paints over the cracks of what's going on between sectors. It's all around tech. You can't go past that. I mean, if you look at the S&P 500, the Magnificent Seven and what they are doing, along with the tech space, which makes up about 21 to 22% of the S&P 500, is drowning out the noise that's going on in the other space. You look at US energy, like here in Australia, US energy is not doing very well. If you look at US banking, it's doing reasonable, but nothing like what's going on with the records that have been driven in technology. You look at Japan and look at where they're going back. They've got actually an interesting conundrum for themselves. They are still a tech industry and they're still a tech space, but they're actually makers rather than sort of the software developers. And you look at the rally that's going back in, you know, your Panasonics of this world. You look at going through their tech space, their auto industry that's now starting to develop. Because not only that, it's not only is it tech, it's also their currency. Japanese products are really cheap to the rest of the world because the Japanese yen at the moment is under unbelievable pressure to the downside. It's problematic at home, but for what they are as a nation, as an actual economy, they're an exporter and it actually helps them. So that's also why the Nikkei is so attractive, is because they've actually started to be able to sell their goods again at a price that is super competitive. And so companies are making a really good return if you're a Japanese player. It's not helping their economy domestically. I understand that. But that's part of the reason why the Nikkei is doing so well, is that the yen makes Japanese goods globally really attractive once more.
You're talking there about tech stocks, right? Many tech stocks also trading at records. The NASDAQ, as I mentioned, at a record. But the last time tech did well was when interest rates were basically zero. Interest rates are a lot higher right now, yet some of these tech stocks are doing particularly well. What's behind that? But at the same time, is the market betting that we'll start getting some interest rate cuts soon, more so in the US?
So on the last part of your question, that's clear. I mean, if you listen to the minutes, although they are still saying they're not confident yet, they're at a stable footing towards 2% of their target, all the data suggests that they're going to get there probably by no later than November this year. So rate cuts are going to start in the States. And they've made that quite clear with their dot plots in terms of what the Federal Reserve members think rates are going to do. So that's one part of it. That's a given. It's locked into forecasts and locked into probably market thinking, considering prices 12 months ahead. In terms of you thinking about tech and where it's at, it's fascinating because, yes, there's no doubt you can make that it's a growth cyclical place that does do well with high levels of gearing, so debt, and it's always looking for growth and always looking for expansion. Again, I'll get back to my S&P 500 and NASDAQ answer from before. The difference this time around is that the drive is coming through highly established, multinational, multi-global players. Your Mag 7 are out of there. So you look at Apple, you look at Meta, you look at NVIDIA and what they're doing. They don't have the level of debt that the GFC or that the dot-com bubble sort of created and the issues that come with that. So the argument about higher rates should put downward pressure on these providers. It's different. They've got products that we still want. The drive into social media has not stopped because of higher interest rates. The drive into AI has not stopped because of higher interest rates, because we see that as the future. We know that this has been described as the third leap in the digital age between computers, the internet, and now this. So you've got specific reasons to look past the macroeconomic issues of higher interest rates and a tighter economic environment. That's why tech is driving it, because it's not like the past. It's not this big movement of all these small speculative positions. These are established players with established businesses that have actually found the next thing to drive them forward.
Tech isn't a huge focus on the Australian share market, right? A lot of those tech companies are in the US, yet our share market now is at a one-week high. We're edging ever so closer to another record. So what's your take on what's driving it and the potential to hit that other record?
Yeah, so we are moving higher. I agree with that, but we're underperforming. I mean, you were asked your previous question about interest rate rises. Australia will feel it. We're already starting to see. We are now into confession season. We're 3.5 weeks away from earnings season. And not only are we getting confessions, we're getting people hitting the wall. So you just look at Booktopia, not a great example, but an example of what higher interest rates will do to an economy and a market like Australia, which doesn't have, as you said, the kinds of things the Magnificent Seven are doing or the tech expansion that we have. We have banks which have done incredibly well, and so they should have, considering that we haven't had the mortgage cliff. And higher interest rates, people will argue, will make margins better. That's true. But higher interest rates also means lower loan growth, higher bad and doubtful debts, and that will hit cash profits. So there's an argument that maybe the banking space could moderate off the back of this. The commodity story is also interesting on the other side of the Australian major part of the index, which is, you know, BHP and Rio have done reasonably well. Iron ore has held above expectations, but they're not at 2021, 2022 levels in iron ore. Coal has come significantly back. You've got an oversupply of nickel and mines being put into mothball. Lithium's all over the shot. So it's not as attractive either in terms of the cyclicality that comes with those parts of our market. And they're the barbell, right? They're the two major components of our market. That's why, although we're getting towards records, we're underperforming the rest of the world and unlikely until rates in this country look like coming down to probably gap up on our global peers.
Can we take a look at one of the corporate stories of the day? That's two potential takeover bids from the Middle East for oil and gas producer Santos here in Australia. Can you run us through how significant this could be and any potential barriers? Now, of course, this hasn't really been confirmed just yet, hey?
Yeah, so could is the correct word in terms of where this sits. So there are rumours that obviously, particularly Aramco sort of sniffing around, that's big deals. I mean, Aramco has been buying up global assets. They very much know they need to transition away from just being an oil giant into transition energy gas. And therefore, you know, Santos ticks that box immediately. It's not just the Australian exposure. It's around the Southeast Asian PNG region as well. Don't forget Santos merged up with Oil Search in terms of what that is. So it fits what they're trying to do globally. It's a massive rumor. And then the second part of your question is, the headwinds. Immediately, you will start to see the Foreign Investment Review Board put up massive red flags around this. There's also concern from a sovereign basis as well, having something like Aramco, which is straight owned by the Saudi royal family. Let's not beat around the bush there either. It's the same equivalent of a state-owned Chinese company making a similar approach. There is going to be massive concerns about sovereignty, massive concerns around what it also means for the assets. Jobs is the next part of that question, going out of the foreign board, how many jobs could be lost, how many jobs could be created. All of those will be the next step, because you can see the federal government, you can see the Foreign Investment Review Board not only asking those questions, but putting those kinds of requirements on a deal of this significance, because it would create quite an interesting strategic problem from an actual political perspective, not just because it's Saudi Arabia, but because those assets are going forward likely to be more and more strategic to the Australia's energy interest rather than we probably give it credit for. And therefore, selling them off now, what does that mean long term? And that's the unknown question.
Okay, finally, in wrapping up, where do you see the opportunities for investors at the moment?
So again, I think you can't go past what is currently going on inside tech, despite the rally. I mean, the rally is there for a reason. The drive that's going in NVIDIA and the NVIDIA space is there. I can't go past that. It is clearly going to be, whether we like it or not, digital tech is there. You then listen to where the money's trying to flow at the moment and what money really wants to invest in. It is still things like the transition space. So you can hear it, although it's not as profitable, the transition energy space is there. You then also look at, for me, that's quite fascinating in terms of that space, is also the commodities around it. So it's not just lithium and nickel. We forget copper is still the most important thing for the transition of the future of not just energy, not just tech, but also the housing scenario as well, because everything's required around it. So for that reason, I still think there's a miss here by the market around how important copper is going to be. And at the moment, we just don't have enough of it. And that's why I think it'll be quite a strategic investment into the future.
That's Evan Lucas there.
This SBS On The Money podcast is provided for informational purposes only. The content on this podcast should not be understood as constituting advice or a recommendation. It is not personal advice and does not consider your personal circumstances or objectives. You should contact a licensed professional before making any financial decision.